next met with Dr. Ghassan Abu Alfa to talk about hepatocellular cancer, and to begin, he provided a broad overview of the strategic approach to HCC treatment.
I would simplify it as such. A small lesion and a good liver, surgery is the standard. There could be some debate. Some surgeons or transplant surgeons might say, no, we got to transplant everybody, but this is beyond the discussion today. A small lesion, bad liver, transplant. Then you get into the locally advanced disease, patients with disease in the liver that you cannot take out. This is embolization. I would like to stress here, though, these are not curative intents. These are palliative therapies that will expand survival based on some two randomized trials that not necessarily were reproduced always, but nonetheless still is an accepted standard.
Incidentally, do you stick with that model if the patient's essentially asymptomatic?
That's a very good point. This is where I would encourage and always support the idea of multidisciplinary team therapy, because when you sit down in those conferences, the simple answers for a tumor just erupted with good liver surgery, that's simple. But what's in between, patients who are asymptomatic, the tumor have been really stable over a period of time, which can definitely happen in HCC. Obviously, there could be some variation on the concept. And yes, sometimes we do vouch for no more than close observation to the patients with a rather stable disease.
I sometimes wonder, though, you know, places like yours, you've got these conferences and everybody's talking together. Out in the community, I kind of wonder if it's a multi-turf thing that happens, not in a conference room, but, you know, just by whatever, who gets to see the patient first. But let me throw back to you another view on the issue of taste. And I mean, I guess actually maybe I should ask you to finish your simple algorithm and then let's go back to taste.
Sure. I mean, to continue the algorithm, so as we said, small disease, good liver surgery, small disease, bad liver transplant, locally advanced disease without any ability to resect, embolization and some variation on some forms of local therapy, and there are many of them which we can discuss. Then more advanced disease, systemic therapy, and of course, if there is a true bad liver function, then probably best supportive care. Now, you bring a very important point, though. The biggest concern that we have is ownership. In other words, if a patient is being seen for taste, got first taste, and there is no definition, the Japanese have a definition, number, and how frequent you do it. But let's assume a simple one, patients evolve with lung metastases. What I don't want to hear, and this is what concerns me, is a physician saying to the patient, well, you have mainly liver disease. Who cares about few lung lesions? Let's keep doing embolization.
Kind of a debulking?
Exactly. The science of the disease is different because the minute there is metastasis, as you and I know as oncologists, that there is simply a rev up in angiogenesis and you have to take care of disease as a systemic disease. Patients always are educated with the idea that here the tumor is smaller, it's darker on the inside. We have to kind of like keep making them understand that there is a concept of survival, which is very abstract, but very critical when it comes to systemic therapy. The other thing is a combination of the dox plus sorafenib in the second line setting after patient fails sorafenib. And again, I would not support it in the clinic yet, but it's very intriguing to us that patients with sorafenib that failed sorafenib after a decent amount of time, and I mean by failed, they progressed on it, you add doxorubicin while keeping the sorafenib, they might actually pull some improvement in survival.
Now, I saw a paper you wrote I thought was really great looking at management of side effects with systemic therapy of HCC. And I always like to ask the people at Memorial who have any connection to diseases where treatments involve dermatologic toxicity, and knowing that Mario Locoutur has come there, I'm guessing you've interacted with him. So maybe I could just ask for, you know, kind of what's new in terms of management of side effects, particularly with using sorafenib.
No question that one of the big challenges other than referral patterns for the patients has been management of side effects for sorafenib. And as we both know, the most common side effects that patients can witness are the hand-foot syndrome, which is a drug-limiting toxicity. It's kind of like more of that tingly, prickly, pinpoint tingling that will evolve into redness and ultimately into probably some of the peeling of the skin in the digits, in the toes, and in the fingers. The other one is diarrhea, and the third one is fatigue. In regard to the hand-foot syndrome specific, Mario has been really a major contributor to the field, and we are so happy to have him at Memorial, and we're working quite a bit together to try to understand better that phenomenon and try to see if we can reverse it. So he developed a model, which I kind of spoke about in that paper, called the RAR model, which is most important is that patients got to make sure that any potential skin that could be damaged, treated beforehand, like, for example, any callus, kind of like healed rather than keep it as dry skin, avoid any of the chemicals, hot water, scrubbing, all those kind of like abrasive things that might occur to the skin. Apply moisturizers and pain medications if need be. But I think the most important of them is reporting. And I think probably this remains an important piece of news. I can say that we pride ourselves at Memorial that we don't have grade 3 hand-foot syndrome because patients are very clearly instructed that after they start therapy, within 2 or 3 days, we are with them on the phone. And in a week time, we're them in clinic to kind of make sure we circumvent any issue. Our referral circle is quite wide, actually about 4,000 nautical miles at the moment. And we have patients travel from far away, so you can't like bring them all the way to clinic. So we kind of came with a device, actually, which is very simple. Everybody has a cell phone, everybody has a camera. So we ask patients to take pictures of their fingers and toes, email it to us, and we line them up. And we can compare, and we have the baseline from the clinic and kind of be able to tell them what to do with the drug, hold, reduce, resume, based on where do they stand in that regard. This gives patients an opportunity to interact, and they feel like responsible or part of the management of the disease. The nurses love it because they are really kind of, you know, integrated into the care on a continuous basis. And I have to say, really, this was able to bring down our hand-foot syndrome to nothing above grade 2.
I love it. Did they ever send you videos?
No, no videos, but we learned a couple of things that patients love to take pictures of their hands and feet because instead of getting one picture, we get 20. And you have to always take care of making sure you don't look on the background. It could be interesting.
Fascinating. And just to repeat, when you talked about the RAR model, that's R-A-A-R, remove, avoid, apply, and report. And I guess the reporting there in terms of the patient, it kind of reminds me of what you hear a lot with capecitabine. You know, they want people to let the team know as early as possible. Another thing that you mentioned in the paper is diarrhea. Anything new with that?
Well, just one more word on hand-foot syndrome is I would tell you, stay tuned because with Mario Lacouture, we're working on understanding the mechanistic basis of the hand-foot syndrome, and we have some hopefully nice research coming up in that regard.
How about diarrhea? You also talk about that in the paper.
Diarrhea is definitely concerning, and I have to say physicians, and we are all culprits sometimes, we're not good listeners and to understand and appreciate what diarrhea means. When a patient comes and tells you they have 7 bowel movements in the morning, this is not really something, but to really understand that it could be very debilitating and not really conducive for patients to continue on therapy. So I would say it's really managerial. We should not be discouraged by it. We have to make sure we listen clearly, make sure we ask the question, and make sure we understand clearly what the patients are going through, and then address it. How do you address it? Avoid spicy foods as a prevention. Avoid things that really can cause continuous diarrhea. Applying antidiarrheals, starting with the Imodium, moving to Lamotil is totally appropriate. And of course, dose adjustment. What patients and physicians sometimes miss is that you don't necessarily need to be on the 400 twice a day dosing. The drug does work. It has a very wide therapeutic window being a biologic agent. And even if you do 2 pills a day or even 1 pill every day or 2 pills every other day, still there's value to the drug. And really, with a little bit of prevention, as we said, a little bit of management of the diarrhea and some dose adjustments, probably patients will be guaranteed an effective dose that they are comfortable with.
How about fatigue?
That's another one that we, of course, again, don't appreciate very much. Patients can be tired. They can really get asthenia even. But in general, it's a fatigue more like, you know, they can't really run their routine or their favorite hobbies or what have we. And again, we kind of like preventive-wise, we push them to really go into a rhythmal cycle, sleep at night, try to wake up during the day, keep exercising, fatigue the body a little bit so they can really fall asleep. And in addition to that, few tricks can happen because the drug can cause a fatigue. And if they end up on being only once a day dosing, we ask them to do it in the evening so they can sleep on it rather than have the fatigue during the day.
So is this kind of somnolence? Because also, isn't there, I don't know, maybe you have to be once or after no longer, sort of a muscle wasting thing too?
Absolutely. There is a lot of those phenomena that happen in regard to muscle wasting and probably some of the those inflammatory events happening in the body were could be maybe a contribution from the whole phenomenon of all what's happening in the interleukins and CRPs. But we don't have a clear understanding of all of that yet. But the fatigue probably is not the cumulative effect that we see with the muscle wasting phenomenon that you're talking about. But really, it can happen right from the beginning. People will tell you, I'm tired. And as such, that's why we kind of like encourage those preventions and ultimately reduce the dose. It's not the end of the world.
How about hypertension and cardiac events?
That's a very good point. Hypertension does occur, and I have to say the cheapest intervention is to ask them to stop salt. Salt intake really make a lot of contribution to this hypertension for whatever reason.
Is this sort of like a VEGF kind of hypertension?
It is probably, and I think there has been a nice paper about that in the literature that really speaks that most likely way to prevent it from occurring is calcium channel blockers, which probably is the class of drug that will contribute in the antiangiogenics.
Because when you said salt restriction, I was just thinking, I don't remember anybody ever saying that about bevacizumab. I don't even know if it's been looked at.
I'm not sure it looked at. This is anecdotal, but we really noticed that patients who are really very good and strict about salt intake, they really will reduce their pressure on sorafenib, and maybe it's something to look into.
That is fascinating. What about cardiac events?
They're rare, but they can occur, and there has been cardiac stunning reported with sorafenib. There has been even cardiomyopathy and drop in the ejection fraction, and something to monitor very carefully. And this is where it becomes a little bit intriguing, because a fatigue concept, tiredness, might not necessarily only be a simple fatigue. We got to dig in a little bit more into the cardiac phenomenon. There's no indication and there's no standard to evaluate EF on a frequent basis, but nonetheless, probably a good inquisitive mind on the physician's side and good listening is very important to make sure we address those if need be.
So one big difference between HCC and other cancers is the frequent presence of significant liver disease. And one of the most common questions we receive from oncologists is what to do with a patient with Child-Pugh B cirrhosis.
And this is maybe to go back to your question about like what's so special about HCC. Yeah, it is a special disease because it's really two problems in one. You have the cancer itself and you have the cirrhosis that usually accompany the disease. In the US, because most patients we see are hepatitis C related and alcohol related, will have cirrhosis. And we got to address that. Classically, we've been using the Child-Pugh score. Just to remember, it's albumin level, bilirubin level, a clinical, very important, clinical ascites, not on CT scan, is what you assess in clinic, on physical exam, a clinical encephalopathy, again, not an ammonia level, it's what you assess on exam. Usually you will see forgetfulness, sleepiness, you know, spacing out, and lastly, PTINR, which are really the five characteristics that will depict how bad the liver function is. Very important, there's a limitation to the Child-Pugh score because it's not a prognostic sign about the tumor itself. Actually, it was not tested even in patients with HCC. It was tested in patients with cirrhosis to find out who might have esophageal varices. But nonetheless, we use it because we are used to it. All the data has been reported in that regard. To go back to the question on HCC, we had in our JCO paper back in 2006, if you recall, a cohort, which is one of the largest ever studied with Child-Pugh B patients with sorafenib. And at that time, the pharmacokinetics were totally decent. They actually showed that patients with quote-unquote a more sluggish liver, like Child-Pugh B, will get rid of the drug at the same rate like a Child-Pugh A. And the drug is actually metabolized through the liver. And we said at that time, it's probably safe to do.
Could I just ask why? It sort of doesn't make sense.
Extremely doesn't make sense, because we said that and then we retracted because we looked anecdotally and it appears to be that patients get more ill on the drug. And could it be that they probably got, interestingly, lower dose to begin with because we adjusted unconsciously to accommodate for symptoms? Very possible. Nonetheless, we found later on in a paper that we have in gastrointestinal cancer research, actually, that patients who are Child-Pugh B have a higher chance of worsening their bilirubin compared to the A, have higher chance of worsening encephalopathy compared to the A, worsening ascites compared to the A. And it appears to be that either this is because the drug itself has an impact on liver functionality, even though I can't prove that because we never had a control arm, or it could be that the Child-Pugh itself, which is not a linear curve, but rather an exponential one, we're catching patients a little bit in a more active or dynamic phase of their disease as it evolved to a little bit of worsening at a faster rate than it is when it's Child-Pugh A. Nonetheless, what does that mean? There is a paper that we published also through CALGB 60301 looking at sorafenib and organ dysfunction that had a really large cohort out of about 130 patients. There were about 30 with HCC. The recommendation for the physicians in the community is If a patient has a bilirubin of less than 1.5, go ahead, use sorafenib at full dose. If the bilirubin is between 1.5 and 3 times normal, I would use half the dose, and I will monitor the bilirubin very carefully. And if the bilirubin above 3, based on that CLGB study I'm mentioning, I will not use the drug.
So people have been talking a lot about your prior work, which you just described, which kind of was a little bit hard to figure out because, you know, as you just said, there are multiple explanations for it. But then there was a lot more data that came out that I'd like to get your take on this past year. I think first at ASCO GI and then at ASCO, I think it was from the Gideon registry, and where they had a huge number of patients who'd gotten sorafenib with Child-Pugh B, and I think at least there was some discussion about Child-C. What was that data? How did they get it? What do you think it means?
So the Gideon, to just give a little bit of background, is what we call a registration study. It's a phase 4 study. Patients are getting drug through the marketed drug. There is no endpoint in regard to efficacy. It's simply just to kind of like understand patterns of care. How do patients get the drug? What dose do they get on? Who are they, etc. And yes, you're right. Actually, Jorge Marrero presented beautiful work in regard to the Gideon update that was first presented by Alan Vinook. And the idea was that they described certain patterns, who gives what kind of dose, who's more comfortable, hepatologist versus oncologist, and there was a piece on Child-Pugh B. But I have to say, two important shortcomings on the Gideon. Number one is, the Gideon is not complete. And number two is, in that data that was reported by Jorge Marrero, there was a lumping of all Child-Pugh B patients together. And as such, we don't know if it's influenced by B7, more than B9, because we know both of us that B7 is as good as an A, and as such, that's why they gave that kind of reassurance that it appears to be that it's tolerable in that population. But I think one of the key questions that I asked Jorge, like any other people did as well, is we would like to see what B7 does compared to B8, compared to B9, to understand better what the pattern is exactly.
I'm not sure how many oncologists in practice, you know, are even calculating Child-Pugh B, let alone, I guess, it's 7, 8, or 9, and think about the difference, because, you know, I'm not seeing that many cases. But I remember at that ASCO presentation, the famous question asker, Dr. Stephen Vogel, I don't know, you probably know
of
him.
Of course.
You know, he's an awesome guy. He's out there, you know, asking everybody questions, and he's like, he stood up afterwards and said, does this mean we give it in Child-Pugh B, not in C? And I thought that kind of the answer was yes. Is that right, or is it more qualified than that?
I think it needs to be a little bit more looked into details. And I really had discussions personally with Jorge, and I said that we need to really make sure we dissect it further, because data from our part, as you just said, is kind of raised some concerns. Data from Japan, similar things, and some other groups here and there. But I think the Gideon will be a nice guidance, because it's really the real patterns of what's happening in real life. But I think we have to dissect it further than just simply lumping it as B.
Any comments about new agents and pathways in HCC? It's been a little disappointing that since sorafenib came out, there's kind of been, seems like a little bit of a vacuum.
That's very true, that so far what we heard has been negative, and I'm afraid that we're probably revisiting the gemcitabine pancreatic kind of era where, you know, you add things or you change things and nothing happened. Nonetheless, in summary, antiangiogenics are still kind of like really in the race and people are still keen on them. Sunitinib is out. As you know, Ann Lee Cheng reported that at ASCO last year.
Before you go beyond that, could you just comment on that? Because I thought that was really fascinating, that those data, particularly in terms of what it showed in the sorafenib arm.
Absolutely. It's a fascinating study because I call it the SHARP 2 because it really was able to reproduce the SHARP number for the sorafenib, 10.2 months, like 10.7. And same time, it was statistically significant, but the other way around.
But it was 7.9. Over sunitinib. It wasn't over placebo.
Absolutely. It was over sunitinib. And this is really a kind of like oncology 101. When was the last time you saw in any disease a phase 2 trial that has a median survival of 10 months in a well-select population because it's a phase 2 that will translate in a better outcome than in a phase 3? It doesn't happen. And this is the unfortunate reality. The 10-month that was noted in the sunitinib 2 studies by Sandrine Favre as well as by Andrew Zhu, unfortunately translated in that 7-plus month in the sunitinib versus sorafenib study of Ann Lee Cheng. Very, very sobering. And it's a reality that we have to understand and realize. The news is there's public information, but there's no details yet. Lenifnib is also negative versus sorafenib.
And what exactly is lenifnib?
Lenifnib is a very specific antiangiogenic, and this is the caching point, is that probably because it's a very potent and very select antiangiogenic, not like really more of a multi-target molecules like sorafenib, could have a better chance with a reasonable toxicity profile. Nonetheless, again, here we go, and median survival in a phase 2 trial is 10 months, and we know that the study is negative even though we don't have the details.
We've been hearing about a really interesting agent in gastric cancer, remucerumab, an antibody. I'm still trying to figure out exactly how it works. Has that been looked at in HCC?
Absolutely. So remucerumab, or I think it's called IMC1121B, is a very select antiangiogenic again, and also it's a full monoclonal antibody of IGF. And if anything, it has been looked at in HCC, and there's currently a second-line study, randomized trial of remucerumab versus placebo in patients with advanced HCC who failed sorafenib.
Any data to think either positively or negatively about this agent? Have you had any experience with it?
Truly, I don't have hand-on experience. I think the concept is reasonable. The data that was presented in the phase 2 kind of made an argument for the issue of the second-line therapy. But here I pose a question about the second line altogether. As you know, the Brivnib study came negative as well. There was a press release on December 22nd saying that it did not meet the primary endpoint when it was comparing patients who failed sorafenib against placebo.
That's a multi-kinase TKI also?
Absolutely. Brivnib is actually anti-VEGF and anti-FGF. And the concept scientifically is that the tumors who fail anti-angiogenic therapy will depend on fibroblast growth factors to kind of like rev up. And the question, if you put an anti-FGF at that point, could it be valuable? We don't have the data. There's no data yet, but there's a press release. But interestingly enough, a lot of chatter is about who are those patients on placebo. Are these the patients that we were seeing back in 2001, where the care was kind of rudimentary, how we take care of patients with HCC, or are we evolving to a different population nowadays of patients who are really seen both into the system much earlier, being taken care of nicely by interventional radiologists, moved to oncology at the appropriate time? This is a kind of evolving and dynamic population. So I think we got to stay tuned and see how this is going to all kind of reveal itself. There will be a lot of learning.
Just to finish out on remucerumab, just so I'm trying to get a better picture of anti-angiogenic strategies. So, you know, I see out there with the ligand, bevacizumab and VEGF trap. I see inside the cell the TKIs like sorafenib. And from what I've seen on some of these schematics, the antibody remucerumab is what, hitting the VEGF receptor on the cell surface?
That's correct, and in addition to the IGF, and this is really the argument that there could be some value by this kind of dual hit.
So I'm just kind of curious, you know, sort of globally, you look in your waiting room today compared to 10 years ago, I mean, sort of addressing what you just said, and not just your waiting room, but the waiting room of oncologists in America who don't have many patients. Do you really think there's a palpable difference in what they're experiencing, how long they're living?
In regard to HCC, yes, no question that there is an improvement in outcome that's not only measured by the use of sorafenib. I think it's measured by other aspects.
Yeah, the whole thing.
Exactly. Better management of cirrhosis, better understanding of the disease, more awareness, coming a little bit forward and get treatment earlier in the game. So I think it's all positive. This is really all positive energy. And I would say still, nonetheless, all physicians in the academic settings and the community got to really be aware that HCC continue to be on the rise. This is not going to be your kind of like rare occurrence in the clinic. This is going to become bread and butter. At the moment, the fastest rate of death among any cancer in men in the U.S. is HCC. And this is just because of the continued increased incidence. So there's a lot happening. Unfortunately, we are seeing more patients. But at the same time, the good news is that probably we're able to help them a little bit better.
In terms of, again, helping them a little bit better, what about survival? Are we looking at, you know, basically the same cure rates, basically maybe 6 months or a year more survival with advanced disease or something more than that?
Well, the numbers that I kind of like will probably quote, historically, doxorubicin, nothing, placebo, 6 months. Now we're talking 10. If you recall, the colorectal cancer story was exactly the same numbers, and now we're at 26. The next number for us, or the next checkpoint for us in HCC, is going to be 14, which is based on the doxorafenib that I just spoke about, if the study comes positive. There's also other efforts like beverlotinib that was carried on by Melanie Thomas. So I think moving from 6 to 14, if hopefully we'll achieve that 14, is quite impressive. Add to this, that survival is only measured at the first line. If the second line kind of like hits some positive results from any of those studies, then of course the cumulative effect will be further survival.
So what about beverlotinib? And for that matter, what do we know about Bev?
So Bev has been studied extensively, as you know. There has been data that came out, Abby Siegel, and there is another report that came from France as well. And it appears to be that there has been activity noticed, but same time, it's a drug that's not easy to handle. And, you know, the bleeding concerns that were noticed when the study was started with Jonathan Schwartz, carried on by Abby Siegel, were definitely not to be ignored. Nonetheless, I think the work that happened at MD Anderson is really very valuable. The whole concept of adding an antiangiogenic to a quote-unquote inactive EGFR inhibitor like cetuximab or erlotinib to that matter really showed that, yes, it might work and there is synergy with that. And I think the median survival that she reported of 15.7 months is quite impressive. Obviously,
so that was a single arm.
Single arm, done at a great place like MD Anderson. All patients were scoped to rule out varices, so quite select. But nonetheless, I think the move to go into a randomized phase 2 study of beverlotinib versus sorafenib is a very healthy move and totally appropriate scientifically. And hopefully this study will accrue and we'll see the results.
I'm guessing you feel there's no role for that combination if you could access it outside a trial?
Again, I'm very clear that any of those therapies should not be used out of clinical trial. And in all fairness, at the moment, there is a major wealth of clinical trials. We have a national commitment to make sure that all those trials accrue. There are opportunities for our patients. And as such, I don't think really there should be an argument about putting patients on clinical studies where needed.
You referred to the increasing incidence of the disease. Can you dissect out a little bit more what's going on? And also, we're starting to hear about this issue of, you know, metabolic syndrome, et cetera. Is that a factor?
Absolutely. So this is a story in the U.S. HCC is truly based on four major risk factors, being hepatitis C, hepatitis B that we see more in cosmopolitan area because of the immigrant population, alcohol, and non-alcoholic steatohepatitis. What has driven it so far has been HCV or hepatitis C and alcohol. Alcohol steadily there, never changed, 25% contribution to all cases. However, the hepatitis C is an interesting story. Hepatitis C is really the silent epidemic. 70s, 80s, if you recall, a lot of patients did get hepatitis C, badly screened blood, accidents at the hospitals with needles, and many other reasons. But I like to make sure that we don't really put a stigma on it. And this is a sad thing because in our mind, it's an IV drug user, a needle that was not clean, a tattoo done at a parlor where the needle was not changed. But in all fairness, there are other people. There are people like just, you know, with a normal way, pace of life, like old elderly women who just went to the dentist and end up with hepatitis C. And these patients do exist. Now, hepatitis C.
Dentist, though. Well, hold on. Before you go beyond that, how do you get it at the dental office?
With the drills.
Being not sterilized?
Not sterilized, exactly. This is what used to happen in the 70s and 80s. And
wow.
This is definitely on the decline now because of better awareness. Any of us, you go to a doctor, if you see a needle, you say, oh, wait a minute, is this sterile? And people are very aware. But interestingly enough, that it takes liver cancer 10 to 30 years to occur after hepatitis C infection in about 5% of the hepatitis C infected patients. So what we are seeing at the moment, a continued surge of hepatitis C-related hepatoma is because of the silent epidemic that we saw in the 70s and 80s. This will continue up to about 2026. After 2026, hep C-related hepatoma probably will be on the decline. But this is not the end of the story. Exactly as you said, because of the metabolic disorder, because diabetes is definitely has a higher risk, type 2 diabetes has a higher risk of developing HCC, morbid obesity, a body mass index more than 31, just to give references, like a body mass index is usually 19 to 25. These are really morbidly obese patients, usually probably diabetic as well. Non-alcoholic fatty liver disease, which is fatty liver without alcohol, leading to NASH, non-alcoholic steatohepatitis, a reasonable chance they will develop hepatoma. The sad reality is, as you know, diabetes and morbid obesity is on the rise, not on the decline. So we're going to have a continued surge of seeing patients with hepatoma due to that factor as well.
What have you seen in your Memorial database in terms of that etiology?
Very nice. What we did actually, retrospective analysis that we published in JCO, right, looking at the different prognostics, but part of it also we looked at the demographics. And probably our pattern is similar to most of the patterns in the country, especially in the two coasts in the center where immigrant populations are. 30%+ are Hep C, 10 to 20 are Hep B, quarter alcohol and quarter NASH. And obviously, I will not undermine that there are other risk factors, including hemochromatosis, other metabolic disorders. And also, of course, sometimes it happens without a risk factor. Rare, but it can happen.
So a patient who has HCC in the setting of NASH, where does that get triaged in terms of transplant versus resection?
There's nothing special about that specific population, because if they have little disease and bad liver, they will go still for transplant.
I mean, these people have bad cirrhosis?
They can have bad cirrhosis. Actually, the classic example, because this kind of like goes silent for a while, they classically have, of course, the plethora of the morbid obesity, the diabetes, extremely low platelets, and some cirrhotic component and some disease. And this is actually classically as seen.
So again, I'm thinking about your waiting room. Then you're saying you got people out there who are morbidly obese or sitting in your waiting room who have NASH and HCC.
Absolutely. And we're going to see more and more of that all over the country.
Wow. What about bile duct cancers and gallbladder cancer?
So bile duct cancers, gallbladder cancer are still kind of understood as one lump, even though we understand the biology probably is different. So there's extrahepatic cholangiocarcinoma, intrahepatic cholangiocarcinoma, and gallbladder cancer. The standard of care remains, since we spoke last time, ABC02 study from the UK by Juan Valle and Bridgewater, that really showed that gemcitabine plus cisplatin versus gemcitabine has an improvement in survival. This is the standard of care. This is what people would use. But interestingly enough, that the pattern have been changing and evolving. If anything, in the ABC02 study, there has been a limit how much patients get of the drug. While in the US, probably we don't limit and we continue. There is a tolerance issue in regard to how much cisplatin you can give. And also now there's a lot of interest in the combination therapy. We had a study ourselves looking at gemcitabine, cisplatin, and sorafenib, and we completed accrual, and we're hoping to publish data very soon.
Sorafenib, what do we know about that in general in these diseases?
Not much really, but the idea was of adding an antiangiogenic therapy with some preclinical models about what could be a synergistic effect between it and the chemotherapy kind of was curious to us, and that's what we did. And we are now looking at combinatorial activities of other drugs with the chemotherapies as well.
You know, a lot of people ask, you know, well, why, you know, you see sorafenib, but what about all the other antiangiogenics? You know, they remember from med school, HCC being, quote, a bloody tumor, and then bringing in also this issue of bile duct cancer. What do we know about angiogenesis in these various cancers? You know, Bob Motzer from your place has presented some cool data on renal cell. Have you used those kinds of studies in HCC?
Well, absolutely. It's a bloody tumor. You're absolutely right. And angiogenesis revs up, and of course, it's a very important target. Why sorafenib? I'm not really sure. Could it be that just pure luck we hit it, like, you know, with the first trial? Could be. But I think there's probably some virtue to the drug itself. The drug is kind of like, how to say, wears many hats, but doesn't show too much. It's not a very potent antiangiogenic. It's kind of like a subtle RAF inhibitor. It's a subtle PDGF inhibitor. And I think this is really where the value is. It's multi-targeted. And this is what these tumors are about.
Going back to bile duct cancers, you know, you kind of see across all oncology, you know, tumors sort of slowly creeping away from chemotherapy trials more towards biologics. And I thought I was starting to hear some things about mutations or assays or, you know, the biology of bile duct cancer that's, you know, starting to maybe have something that we could look at.
Yes, of course. And I think one of the key things that are being worked on is trying to understand if, after all, the biology is different for those three categories I mentioned, being intra, extrahepatic, and gallbladder cancer. Will it mean anything in regard to therapy? And I think this is a key question. We don't know yet. Do I see any clinical trial that will be directed to one specific one of those? Probably not yet, even though I'm sure it will happen one day.
I guess the problem is there are not that many patients, I guess, in tumor assays. I mean, do we know anything about the biology of these tumors?
Truly, not much is known. If anything, most of the concepts are borrowed from pancreatic cancer. And interesting enough that the mechanistics of they evolve on the embryologic origin level continues to be a point of debate.
So the last thing I want to ask you about is just going back to HCC and ask you, what's new in terms of looking at adjuvant systemic therapy? What trials are out there right now? When are we going to get some answers in terms of these questions?
So same kind of point. I do not recommend any adjuvant therapy in HCC yet in the clinical practice because there's no data. Nonetheless, we're definitely awaiting for the results of the sorafenib versus placebo after resection study that probably is anticipated within a year or two to be reported. The study is completely accrued. It's a matter of just waiting for the data to mature. Interesting enough and nice to see another anti-angiogenic called PI88. Actually, it's an anti-heparin that kind of like was on the radar screen several years ago. We were involved and actually, the company got bankrupt from Australia. I was informed that actually a company in Taiwan bought the drug and the study is up and running again. PI88 versus placebo. Very interesting drug that we'd like to see. This was based on a phase 2 study, randomized phase 2, two different doses of the drug versus placebo that showed an improvement in recurrence-free survival in patients with HCC. This is one of the rare instances where a drug is not tested in metastatic setting but only in adjuvant setting.
So getting back to your issue about not using adjuvant treatment off study, would you agree or disagree that the overall risk of relapse after resection, not transplant, but resection for HCC is maybe 70%?
That's very true. Sadly, it is between 50 and 85%. And as such, really, we are in very, very deep need for a preventive or adjuvant treatment.
So again, in a patient, when you are able to really look at all the factors, is more trending towards the 80, 85%, again, no sorafenib?
Still no sorafenib because we don't have the proof. And remember, already we spoke about the side effects, the potentials. Having side effects on a cured patient probably is an unfair opportunity. And as such, I would be a little bit cautious.